Welcome to Telling Tales, a program devoted to the spoken word. I'm Ms. G. Today, Gustavus writer Hank Lindfer reads a selection from his book, Faith of Cranes, Finding Hope and Family in Alaska, as well as offering insight into why he wrote the series of essays, published by Mountaineers Books. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the words of Hank Lindfer.
I'm Hank Lindfer. I live over in Gustavus. I've been in Alaska all my life and settled into a little town over there, not too far from my hometown of Juneau, because I was drawn to the power and beauty of the Icy Strait Glacier Bay landscape, and I have since fallen deeply in love with the human community that is settled into that landscape. I first became aware of cranes when I was nailing the last roof boards onto the top of my house in Gustavus. It was fall time and these birds flew right over at treetop level. And I held onto my hammer and teetered on that roof and watched those birds. And I've realized since then the great good fortune I had in building my home directly under the flight path of those birds. And they've filled my falls and my springs with the beauty of their calls, and they're a magnificent bird that travels in these huge flocks, and they're loud and they just fill up the entire sky. When they show up in the spring, it's like light returning to a black and white world. So the quiet and the dark of winter is replaced when these birds travel past in the spring. They fill my life with a rhythm that's actually that echoes much beyond just their annual migration. They've been flying through North America or across North America for over 10 million years. And I think people can somehow sense the longevity of this bird when they fly over, and they've certainly captivated me. When I was watching my wife's belly swell with our child, I thought about the force that was, gathering all those cells into this growing creature, and I realized our child was coming into the world with no fear of the future. And I get the same sense that cranes are migrating without spending a lot of time worrying about what the future brings. They're just simply following this very visceral, instinctual life force. And so there's the faith of those cranes moving through the world and the face of my child coming into the world. Felt like one and the same faith. And it was a faith that I wasn't feeling, and it was a faith I wanted to cultivate and feel more strongly myself.
Howling wolves and slamming doors. Every road in Gustavus is a dead end. It takes a plane, a boat, or a hell of a stout pair of hiking boots to actually leave town. I first drove the 10 miles of dirt roads in a well-rusted yellow Datsun pickup that set me back $500. Mind the brakes, my neighbor said as he pocketed my check. Rear right is the only one with any grip. Slam 'em hard and it'll jerk you right into the ditch. I didn't really need brakes back then. The thick dust and deep ruts kept me, like most folks, from driving too fast. Stopping is easy when you're going slow. Like a drought discussed among farmers or salmon prices among fishermen, road conditions dominated our conversations.
Getting bad, isn't it?
Hell yeah. Been pounding the piss out of my kidneys.
Gets any worse, I'm liable to bruise my brain.
We all recognized each other by the cars we drove. An arm out the window or a flash of the headlights meant stop and chat. It was a rare trip to the post office that I didn't encounter a pair of trucks parked in the middle of the road, elbows and hat brims poking through open windows, people jawboning about whatever. Unable to get around,
I'd gladly coast to a stop and join the discussion. A half a dozen or more people might gather. Beers emerge from the rubble of someone's truck. Dinner plans were made. Political differences aired. Fishing advice passed along. Lost loves mourned.
Well, gotta go.
Yeah, me too. Got stuff to do. Someone would start a truck and the meeting would end. In just two generations, the short stretch of Boston-born pavement, laid when my grandfather was a boy, arced across the rivers and wound through the mountain ranges, stretching from coast to coast. Even Gustavus, tucked into the folds of an Alaskan archipelago, could not escape. We were found out, and the snake spread 10 miles of smooth, quiet blackness before moving on. I admit that I cursed the old road along with everyone else. I didn't like breathing the clouds of dust. I didn't like it when the bumper rattled off my truck, taking the headlights with it. But I also didn't like seeing the barge, heaped with gravel and trucks, pull into town. A batch plant was erected near the beach, a tall, foreign-smelling thing accentuated by a steady plume of smoke. All summer, the batch plant dumped its belly load of blackness into the mouths of stained trucks. The kids were outfitted with new rollerblades and skateboards in anticipation. They tried their new wheels on the still steaming asphalt. They wobbled about, shrieked, and clung to each other for balance. That whole summer, the steady whine of the paving machine woke me each morning and hung in my ears at night. Changes to town were subtle, yet irreversible. My old yellow truck lost its back bumper and then finally died altogether. It left town on a scrap metal barge, jumbled high with other relics from the rough road days, replaced now by shiny minivans, trucks with push-button windows, and sports cars with the clearance of sandbox toys. As Yogi Berra said, "The future ain't what it used to be." Although we gained a smooth surface that didn't rattle our rigs and shake our kidneys, a lot got buried beneath the pavement. The saddest change for me was the loss of our middle-of-the-road meetings. The tradition lingered for a month or two. I made a point of waving people down whether I had anything to say or not. Folks stopped, but rarely shut off the engines. Cars piled up, but no one got out. People stayed in their rigs, tapping the wheel, afraid the snake would swallow idle cars. Conversations were rushed. Pretty soon, they were not worth having at all. We built our home several years before the pavement. During a lunch break, Anya and I rattled down the dusty road in the yellow Datsun to check the mail. On the way back to pound more nails, Sam's blue Ford, parked on the roadside, emerged from the dust like a ship in the fog. I coasted to a stop, careful not to touch the brakes. Sam was leaning against the driver's door, legs and arms folded, watching something across the road. Anya and I followed Sam's gaze to a black lump on the opposite shoulder. The lump lifted its head, looked our way, and then settled its muzzle back into the dust.
"Been there all night. Saw him before dark," Sam explained. "Was out walking the mutt. It was moving more then, dragging itself along the ditch."
Sam is a gruff man with a heavily furred neck that slides in an easy curve into his massive chest and round belly. He owns a poodle-type dog that he calls a damn barking bedroom slipper. But when no one is looking, he slips the dog a treat from the pocket of his work shirt.
"What happened?" I asked. "All's I know is a couple of gunshots went off last night round supper time. Come from the direction of Tom's place. Weren't no rifle. Sounded like a shotgun."
The bear swung its head through the gravel.
"Why didn't you kill it last night?" I asked. No way. Out of season. State trooper had me filling out forms till my hand cramps up.
We leaned against Sam's truck a while, watching the dying bear. When we got back to the house site, I couldn't concentrate on carpentry.
I think I'll go get my gun, I told Anya, dropping my tool belt.
I'll go with you, she said. When we returned, four cars were parked along the ditch, doors open, people quietly gathered around the hood of an old white pickup. Shelley, a nearby neighbor, told me that the bear had dragged itself into the woods. I loaded my gun and stepped into the forest. Just beyond the range of whispering voices, I glimpsed the bear. It lay between two pines, head up, looking at me. I braced the rifle against a tree. I centered the crosshairs below the round bump of its ears. The gun roared. The head dropped. I slowly walked through the bear. The night black fur rose and fell with slow breath. The hind legs, with a sudden kick, pushed the round body out from the tree. I raised the rifle to shoot again and then lowered it. The skull was already shattered. More bullets couldn't make it die any faster. Anya was the first to reach me. I pulled her warmth under my arm. We stepped closer and saw a red, jelly-like puddle pooled beside the slightly open mouth. The skin on the front shoulder and back leg trembled like a horse quivering to scare off flies. Anya and I have watched many deer die, have seen the shivering skin and the slow curling of legs. My father called it nerves. I see it as a draining of life, a slow slide that lingers after pulse and breath have stopped. I often leave deer after they are shot, take a walk to calm my pulse and return when the animal is still. For some reason, I did not leave the bear. I moved closer and sunk my fingers through the thick fur to the trembling skin. I was thankful for Anya's hand on my shoulder. Shelley wound through the trees with a shovel. Anya and Shelley grabbed one front paw and I the other as we tugged the bear's bulk away from the pine to a forest opening. Digging will be easier here, Shelley said. Not so many roots. I sliced the shovel into the sandy soil. I was just starting to sweat when Tom arrived with another shovel and two knives.
I'll dig. Don't much like skinning, Tom said.
Anya and I accepted the knives and began peeling hide from flesh. We were soon enveloped in the subtle waft of grease and musk. Between heaves of the shovel, Tom told the story of noise on his porch. It was dark. He chased the bear down the stairs and fired a shotgun, aiming over the top of the fleeing animal. A bold bear. A bear self-taught in the lucrative but risky business of snitching human food. Tom did not mean to kill. I have since chased many bears off my own porch. I use a slingshot instead of a shotgun. I send them down the path with a barrage of whizzing stones. I do my best to hit them hard. If I can get bears to associate houses with bruises instead of bread, perhaps they will not prowl for snacks at households that keep a loaded rifle inside the door. Skinning Tom's bear, the soft thickness of fur gave way to the hard lines of marbled muscle. I couldn't help but think of the muscles wrapped around my own bones. I couldn't help but picture the resemblance of my own skinned form, peeled of personal identity and laid alongside the bear. When I found two places where pellets penetrated the hide and slid between ribs, lodging in the bear's belly, I thought of the slow burn, stomach juice and blood filling spaces where they shouldn't be.
I wonder what the state'll do with the hide. Sure would make a nice rug, Tom said,
up to his waist in the bear's grave.
Maybe Tom was trying to salvage something from the loss, or maybe he was simply trying to penetrate the quiet that covered us like a cold fog. I slashed the hide in long parallel slices. There would be no rug.
You're listening to Telling Tales, today featuring Gustavus Ryder reading selections from his book, Faith of Cranes, Finding Hope and Family in Alaska.
Decades in front of the paving machines, pioneers pushed across the continent, shooting all the bears in their path. I am among the last of the pioneers. I can't go any farther west. Neither can the bears. Neither can the asphalt. So, here we are, pinned between the encroaching urban world and the steady waves of the Pacific. The bears are being bears, pushed by a deep curiosity, drawn by a keen nose in the relentless search for calories. The people are being people, drawn to the quiet and charm of the wilds and comforts and convenience of modern living. The asphalt is being asphalt, covering the bumps, dips, and dust so the Industrial Revolution can roll smoothly on. The bears did not invite the people, but the people invited the pavement. The paving was debated through a long series of town meetings. In the end, there were no arguments more convincing than the old road itself, with its bone-jarring, truck-rattling ruts and choking clouds of dust. When the vote was finally tallied, my hand was one of the few raised in opposition. The town accepted the government's offer, and we awaited our inclusion into the system of federal highways. After the vote for government-sponsored pavement came the vote for government itself. When I first came to Gustavus, there was no mayor, no city council, no taxes, no cops. Technically, we were not a city at all, just a group of folks living near one another. Neighbors pooled money to get the streets plowed. Someone organized a softball league. Someone else started up a landfill. Another group raised the funds for a library. Overworked volunteers complained that the new arrivals did not understand the spirit of volunteerism. The same dedicated 30 people were doing the work for the whole community. Proponents of city government said we needed the teeth of law to get everyone to pay their share. They warned unregulated growth would scar the face of our pretty town. We needed planning money. We needed to get organized. City opponents took the, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, posture. They warned of government waste, the sour taste of regulations, overspent city budgets. The debate was lively and contentious. The vote happened in late winter. Turnout was high. We became a city by just a few votes. Not only did I check yes on my ballot, but I put my name on that ballot. I agreed local government was a tool needed to shape the town's inevitable growth. I took a seat on the first city council for the same reason I served on the board of two conservation groups, for the same reason I wrote letters to editors, governors, and senators. Without organized resistance, the insanity that passed for progress would never stop. I explained to the new city council that every metropolis on the continent was, at some point, the size of our dear town. Bears once sniffed along the Atlantic coast for food. The only difference between Galveston and Gustavus was time. The pattern is clear, but we can do it differently, I said. We can preserve quiet evenings and dark nights, promote gratitude instead of growth. I suggested a carbon tax and a communal bike repair shop. I supported sliding fees for our community clinic. I'd ask, at the beginning of a meeting, if anyone else had heard the wolves howling last night. No one had. Tolerance for my ideas quickly thinned to impatience, and then lightly veiled hostility. Perpetual progress, I soon realized, was the underlying gospel. an assumed mission and starting point for the council. I was a token heretic, the lone pain in the ass, and impediment to the work at hand. New city letterhead and crisp business cards were cheap tickets into the offices of senators and congresspeople. The trough of public money runs deep, and my fellow councilmen couldn't scarf it up fast enough. Soon, we were lined up for a new dock, new runway lights, new boat harbor, new graveyard, new landfill. The plow of ambition that cut across the prairie was cutting through my hometown. After a particularly discouraging council meeting, I took a walk to the wide wetlands west of town. My friend Char Fox joined me. She was in town for a few days, getting a break from the bustle of cars and buses passing her downtown Juneau home. We were just past the end of the road when the first wolf howled. Char and I stopped mid-step and tilted our ears toward the rich call. We cocked our heads off to the right when the second wolf answered. Then the whole pack joined in, calling from all sides. The animals were close, moving through the sparse trees across the open wetlands. The howls drifted toward each other and then erupted into a cacophony of yips and barks as the pack reunited. When the animals fell silent, Char turned to me, eyes moist with gratitude. A whispered, "Wow," was all she could manage. We stood for a while to see if the wolves would start back up. A few mosquitoes buzzed in the wide silence. We slowly started for home, boots sloshing loudly through the wetlands. Char floated along, moving through the echoes. I tromped beside her, braced against a future of slamming doors. Where Char saw willows and pines aglow in the evening light, I saw the plat map that had the open country around us neatly divided into one-acre house lots. Gripped by a fear of the future, my mind magnified each small change. Each new home would spread the seeds of sprawl. Each new car would edge us another step closer to congestion and stoplights. The looming losses drained the beauty from my day. What I didn't share with Char, what I hadn't told the city council, what I couldn't even admit to myself, was my frustration in feeling my own feet in lockstep with progress marching over beauty. Bears used to snuffle for berries where my house stands. The boards for my home came from a mile-long canyon I cut through a forest to push a dead-end road a little farther west. Having moved to Gustavus to get away from the urbanization of America, I couldn't accept that part of me was glad the asphalt had come, glad that I could ride my bike without plugging my lungs with dust. Not knowing how to yell at myself, I got mad at everyone else. Char and I paused before stepping onto the road leading back to town. A ruby-crowned kinglet fluttered from a willow tree behind us and snapped at an insect from the air. The evening was so still that we could hear the quick snip, snip, snip of that teeny beak. "Bring your grandkids here," I told Char, "and the wolves will be gone. Stand right here, and the sound of bird beaks will be buried beneath pounding hammers and whining lawnmowers." I continued my rant as we walked the road back to the house. I dragged my friend into the future of leaf blowers and barking dogs, motorbikes and screaming kids. Char didn't try and stop me. She listened with silent patience. But before we climbed the steps into the house, she turned to me with a touch on the arm. She placed a hand on my chest and said, "Hank, the wolves are still here."
You've been listening to Telling Tales, today featuring Gustavus writer Hank Lintfer, reading a selection from his book, Faith of Cranes, Finding Hope and Family in Alaska, published by Mountaineers Books. This program was produced by Jeff Brown in the studios of KTOO-FM in Juneau, Alaska. I'm Ms. G. Thanks for tuning in.